things I want to do today. I hope they're all reasonably short. Since the last lecture, actually, I've come to understand the factoring algorithm in a slightly different way, which I think is better. It's not just better for its own sake, but I got it off a different account of the algorithm on the web, actually. I saw suddenly it's fairly obvious such a thing must exist, but I'll show it in a moment. But it has the added advantage that it, I'll be talking about the discrete logarithm problem as well, and somehow this other approach generalizes in a way that's much more transparent, I think, to the discrete logarithm problem. So I'll talk about those two. I also want to talk about how you actually do the quantum Fourier transform with a few, not too many gates. That would be a quick thing as well. And what was the last thing? I want to talk about uncomputation, which I mentioned briefly last time. Let's start, since it's underlined everything, let's start with the quantum Fourier transform and how to do it fairly quickly. So, I'm just going to draw a diagram, and I'm going to try and make it rather similar to the way people draw diagrams in this area to represent quantum circuits. So the classical circuits is fairly easy. You've got directed graphs, and you've labeled the nodes according to whether they're OR gates or AND gates and so on. It's a little bit harder with quantum, or somehow a slightly different notation seems to be called for. And I will just define the following gate. I'll define an RK gate to be given by the unitary matrix 1, 0, 0, e to the minus 2 pi I over 2 to the k. So we should think of this as taking 0 to 0 and 1 to e to the minus 2 pi I. Quite a few of those operations. So here's a diagram. I'll just draw the diagram and I'll explain how to interpret it, and I think that will be enough probably. So we'll have our input bits. Let's put one more. Down to JN. So we want to take this input bit or any superposition of that and get something on the right hand side that will give us the Fourier transform. And just perhaps I should remind you of the formula for the Fourier transform. It was I've now got it with J's rather than X's. Suppose I'll write it in terms of that. So it's 1 over square root of 2 to the n naught plus e to the minus 2 pi I point j f 1, and then we have 0 plus e to the minus 2 pi I point j n minus 1. I think that's the last thing I want to say. I wrote it in terms of x instead of j's. I got that the wrong way around. No, I think that's okay. So I want to produce a quantum circuit that realizes that. So the first step I've learned by practicing doing this diagram is very important, not to draw more horizontal line than you absolutely have to at any stage, otherwise it's unlikely to rub things out. So first step is going to be a Hadamard gate. So remember that one is the one with matrix 1, 1, 1, minus 1. And the next step will be a controlled R2 gate. So I do R2, but only if J2 equals 1. So that's what this notation means. R2 means I do an R2 gate, but if I've got a little sort of node thing there, and a vertical line that says only do it if this one equals 1. If you think about it, that's just as good as a unitary operation. You're taking the
instead of doing the unitary operation to both halves of the cube corresponding to what the value of J2 is, we're fixing one half and doing a unitary operation to the other half, and that's still fine. Next step, we do a control R3 gate, and this time the qubit that's controlling it, unsurprisingly, is J3. And then we, I think this is now safe, go all the way up to an RN gate, still controlled. And now we say, well, thanks very much, J1. And I made a mistake the last time I did this. I've then drawing a nice big vertical line there and then wishing I'd put some dots in it. So I won't draw anything there yet. But we'll have a Hadamard gate applied to J2. And then the process, that's fairly obvious what I'm going to do next. Change the phase, that's a bit of motion. So let's try and see what happens to J1 during this complicated operation. So when we do a Hadamard gate, that takes naught to the 1 over square root of 2 naught plus 1. One over the square root of 2, naught minus 1. So you notice that what we end up with will be a naught. Either way, we'll end up with a naught plus e to the minus 2 pi I. Point. Something's not funny. Point J1. One. And then the square root of 2. Which is not precisely what I wanted, actually. Yes, sorry, that is okay, sorry. So far, when I've done the Hadamard gate, I will get 0 plus e to the minus 2 by I point J1, 1, because, over root 2, because if it was 0, that's what I've got, and if it was 1, that's what I've got. Now let's see what happens when I apply the controlled R2 gate. Well, that's what that says is, if J2 reads 0, do nothing. And if J2 reads 1, then multiply the 1 part of it by 2 pi I over 2 squared, which is the same as changing this to e to the minus 2 pi I point J1, J2. Sorry, e to the minus 2 pi I over 2 squared. So I've put in the point, made that into a point J1, J2. And as I go on, I end up getting this bracket here. Now, you might say, well, wasn't I trying to get this? But it turns out that the way you need to do it is to get the things in the wrong order and then do a further operation, which I'll talk about to get them into the right order. So
The Hadamard gate in the first place gives you 1 over root 2 times the combination that depends on the first digit. And then the other controlled gates give you the other digit. Now you might ask, why don't you just have a controlled gate? But the trouble is we're trying to do something to the J1 itself. So the Hadamard thing is a slight sort of trick to get a sort of a controlled R1 gate, so it's not really a controlled R1 gate.
In the second line, do you want to go R2 up to N minus 1 rather than R3 up to Rn?
Oh yes, I think I do, yes, you're absolutely right. Because I want to do a sort of cruder phase operation, right? So what I've produced here is 0.0 J and J1. Yeah, thank you very much. I was getting confused because I was sort of somehow going to my mind that the third bit always controlled in R3 and so on. So yes, I'd absolutely right. So sorry about that. So R2, Rn minus 1, and okay, so now the pattern is clear. Perhaps having seen that, we ought just to check what happens for the second bit as well. But anyway, the first one, I think we can see, ends up with this last bracket. So what happens for the second one? Well, this time it'll give, when you do the Hadamard gate, it'll give 0 plus e to the minus 2 pi I point J2. And then when you do a controlled R2 controlling up with J3, that'll give us a point J3, etc., etc. So, yeah, with that important correction, we've got a circuit that works out the quantum Fourier transform. What about reversing the gates? Well, then you just do things like taking the first qubit and the last qubit and saying, reverses the order of these brackets and gives us the quantum Fourier transform that we really wanted. Nielsen and Twang say, well, this is actually incidentally a proof that the quantum Fourier transform is a unitary mass, because it's represented as a composition of unitary mass, but I think it's sufficiently easy, or sort of easier somehow to check directly that it's unitary than it is to decompose it in this way. But if you've got to decompose it in this way and you're feeling super lazy, then I suppose you don't have to check that it's unitary. Okay, so roughly how many operations does it take? As I said last time, proportional to n squared anyway, because you've got n plus n minus 1 and so on, and then you've got those final swapping bits at the end. While I'm at it, perhaps I'll talk about uncomputation quickly. So the point here is that you want to exploit, I mean the whole point of quantum computation is you want to exploit superposition. And if you've done some classical computation and produced some garbage bits, then some things that ought to be adding together are now being sort of tensor producted with some different stuff over there, and then they don't interfere with each other anymore. So it's very important to make sure that that doesn't happen. And there's a little dodge for doing so. So supposing we've got some reversible computation that allows us to compute from x some state fx. This is all classical, so I don't really need to think. Oops, I think I'm not going from d. States. And I'll just say we reversibly compute function x goes to fx, except we weren't really able to do that. What we had to do is add some extra stuff here and produce fx gx, where gx was some, as they call them, garbage bits that we don't really want. So the trick for dealing with this is you start with x naught, naught, y. Now, y is some fixed state, no matter what it is. It could take it to be zero for the purposes of discussion, but I deduce from the fact that people always talk about y, it's sometimes useful to talk about a more general y. And what do we do then? We do a reversible computation that starts by taking this thing to x, fx, gx, y. So how do you get the... maybe we could actually have naught x, naught y or something, but how do you get the x? You use c naughts. So if you've got the zero and you want to copy an x into a thing with zeros, I would say if this first bit's a 1, I'll change the first bit of the 0, and if this first bit, the second bit's a 1, I'll change the second bit, etc. So copying a classical state in that way is easy. There's something else I could say, something called the no cloning theorem, which one should be aware of, which says that you can't take a quantum state and just duplicate it so that you can't get from. There's no quantum process you can do that will get you from whatever state you've got to it times an independent copy of itself. Basically because, just check, that's not a unitary. But this is all right. Now once you've done that, you then copy the garbage, sorry, you copy what you want, sorry, f of x onto y. Again using c naughts. So now you get fx gx. That's a mod 2 sum of y plus fx. So what are we doing here? We're just going through the bits of f, and if this one's a 1, I'll change the first bit of y, and if this one's a 1, I'll change the second bit of y, etc. So we get that. Once you've got that, you recall that the process that you did for getting from x naught naught to x fx gx was reversible. So you just reverse it, and you get from here to x naught naught y plus fx. So in particular, if y had been 0, you've now got x fx, which is what you wanted, rather than x fx gx. But I'm not going to say in complete detail where that, how we sort of put that trick into Shaw's factory, but just to say that you have to do that in one or two just to make sure that the interferences really work after you've done some classical computations. So now, what's this other way of looking at the factoring algorithm, in particular at looking at the order finding part of it? So what I did last time, the spiel went something like this. Supposing by some miracle we had a vector us equals 1 over the square root of r sum, j equals 0 to r minus 1 of j, a to the j, where a was the thing you were trying to find the order of. And then also we observed that was an eigenvector of a certain unitary operator u, and so on. And then we said, at the end of all that, well, we can't actually prepare this stick because we don't know what r is, but we observed that if we take a superposition of all of those us's, then you just get state 1, which you can prepare, etc. Now that may have looked... It's sort of pretty clear that if you can do that, then you could have just done the whole process to 1 and just decided to see what happens. And I just hadn't got my head around what did happen when you started with 1. But now I have, and it seems to be much simpler. I think just saying all this stuff about, suppose by some miracle, blah, 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 which in fact you don't need a miracle, is maybe not the best way of thinking about it. So it is completely equivalent, so it's not too bad actually to see both ways. So here's another way of viewing what we did last time. It's to say, what we can prepare is the following state. So we've got some capital N. We're trying to work out what the order of A is mod N. So we produce the following state, and then we just stare at that a bit, and we think to ourselves, this part of it is cycling round, or not exactly cycling round, but it's periodic with period R, and it's R that we want to work out. So there's a sort of fairly simple thing we could think of doing, which is to measure the second register. And the second register is going to give us a random power of A. It's going to give us randomly one of the numbers, 1A, up to A to the R minus 1. Once we've measured the second register and got the particular power, A to the S or something like that, or A to the T rather, what have we got here? Well, we must have had a J that gave rise to the power A to the T. Now, which J's give rise to the power A to the T? Well, we just need A to the J congruent to A to the T mod N, which is the same as saying J is congruent to T mod the order of A, mod R. So what we actually get when we measure the second register here is a sort of L2 average, 1 over the square root of we get an arithmetic progression consisting of all those J's that are congruent to some random residue class mod R. And the normalizing factor will be 1 over the size of that projection, which will be of that progression, which will be approximately 2 to the n divided by R. So what we've got now, when we do that, is a vector that looks like this. So it takes the value, some particular normalizing factor, every time you're congruent to T mod R, and 0 everywhere else. And we then think that sort of periodicity is the kind of thing that's picked up by Fourier transforms. And so we just take the Fourier transform of this. And one way of thinking about what you get when you take the Fourier transform actually relates to these US's. It's to say, well, this vector here, I'll forget about normalizing factors for now. So this vector here is precisely what you get if you take the average over all vectors that go something like 1 e to the minus 2 pi over r, e to the minus 2 pi 2 over r, etc., etc. So one thing will be going, will be a geometric progression with common ratio e to the minus 2 pi I over r, and then the next vector I'll talk about will be e to the minus 2 pi I 2 over r and 4 over r, etc. And the next one will be a geometric progression with common ratio e to the minus 2 pi I 3 over r, etc. Take the average of all those, and you get 1 every time they all line up and 0 every time they don't line up. And these things here are precisely the ones that we talked about before, which when you take their Fourier transforms give you a very, very sharp spike, which will then tell you what the phase is. So going back to this, what that says is that the Fourier, you could also alternatively do it just completely directly. What is the Fourier transform of this vector here? It's something that's got spikes every time you get a multiple of 1 over r, so it's precisely the thing that we had before, all superimposed, and then we do a random measurement and get a random s over r. It was pointed out to me after the last lecture that I said something, well, you could sort of just about twist my words to make them mean what they were supposed to mean, but I'm being honest and say that they didn't mean that in my brain when I said them, so... just going back to when we do manage to find a random S over R, I said, well, you could just wait, and if S is prime, then you're okay. Now, if I say it as vaguely as that, it can be interpreted in a correct way, but what if you're just given, if what comes out when you do the, you get this approximation, you do the continued fraction algorithm, and you say, aha, I've got 3/5, that doesn't actually tell you that R equals 5, because it could have been, you know, 30 over 50 or something like that. But if the real S
is prime. So what you do is you don't say, aha, right, now I know that R is 5 because that's prime. You say, whatever you get out, you just say, well, let's assume I got lucky here and the denominator of this fraction is my R. Then you go away and check whether A to the R really does give you 1 mod n and whether A to the R over 2 doesn't give you 1 and so on. If it doesn't work, why don't you just run your computation again and hope you better luck next time. And then what we know is that if your S over the real R had been prime, then you would have been lucky and things would have been all right. So in other words, you've got real R is 100. If S is 71, and you see 71 over 100, you say, oh, 71's prime. And so you don't. The fact that 71 is prime means that you're not going to cancel this down and be unlucky. And that will happen with reasonable probability. But if you see 71 over 100, you don't actually know that it wasn't 142 over 200. So that was the point I didn't quite make clearly last time. However, I should just mention there is another way of dealing with things. Supposing I did ran the experiment twice and got S over R and S dashed over R and S dashed were co-prime. Now these aren't what I'm necessarily going to see because I'll be reducing them to their lowest terms. But if I reduce both these fractions to their lowest terms and I get A over B and C over D, then if S and S dashed are co-prime, it's quite easy to check that the lowest common multiple of B and D has to be R, because in order to cancel S and R down to get A over B, I had to cancel different things from the ones that I had to cancel or from the primes that I was doing when I cancelled S dashed over R to get C over D. So another way of doing it is just to run the experiment twice and hope that when you take the lowest common multiple of the denominators, you'll be okay. And what's the probability that you're okay? It's the probability that a random pair of integers is co-prime. And that's much better than the probability that a random integer is prime. Random integers being co-prime, I believe, it's a probability related to pi squared over 6, I think. Perhaps is it? I don't know, it might be 6 over pi squared or something like that. Whichever one of them is less than 1, so I think. So there you actually only have to run the thing a constant number of times before you're overwhelmingly likely to succeed, rather than a logarithmic number of times in A or polynomial number of digits. And now I'm going to give you a very, very brief sketch of what to do with the discrete logs. So the discrete logarithm problem is this. We've got an A. Because we've got a quantum computer handy, we've managed to calculate what the order of A is mod N, and we've worked out that it's R. Now somebody evilly raises A to a power, they don't tell us what that power is. But they just say B equals, it's congruent to A to the S. And they don't evilly do that because they're trying to send some message using RSA to somebody else. Or something like that. Anyway, we are given a B and challenged to find the S for which A to the S is congruent to B. So here's roughly what you do. Instead of what we're going to create is the following state. I put x and y, and then I calculate what a to the x. B to the y. And that's everything's mod n. A to the b to the y mod n. By the way, I can create this state because I do know what r is now. So I just sort of go up to r. I worked out the order of r. I'm going to oversimplify it the following way. I'm going to assume that we can work out the Fourier transform exactly in Zn, where in fact I would have to do a power of 2 and do some approximations, but let's just pretend we didn't have to do the approximations and that we had a super fast quantum Fourier transform for any n, which is not the case, but
I hope you can just believe me that you do this, then you work out what modifications you need to make. If in fact your quantum Fourier transform was for a power of 2 that was a certain amount bigger than n, gave you good approximations instead of exact answers. I just want to give you the essence of the idea here. So we're going to follow this second way of looking at things, and we just measure the last thing and see what that tells us about the first lot. So having created this state, we measure this, and we get, we don't know what it is, but we will get some power a to the t. So we don't know what t is, but we'll get some a to the t. Now what can we say about the set of pairs now, x, y, that could have given rise to a to the t? Well, they are pairs. We need, it's all pairs such that a to the x, b to the y is congruent to a to the t mod n, which is the same as saying that, now bearing in mind that b equals a to the s, it's the same as saying that x plus sy is congruent to t mod r. So when we measure this, then for some t, we're going to get the set of all x, y, such that x plus sy equals t, which means that we can say x is congruent to t minus sy. So now we want to ask ourselves, well, actually what we want is, we've got a set of pairs with x depending linearly on y, so it's sort of some very nice structured subset of ZR squared. So what we want to talk about here is the Fourier transform mod R. Sorry, the Fourier transform in ZR squared. So not just... So let me just quickly, briefly digress and tell you what a two-dimensional Fourier transform is. I could just say, well, Fourier transforms on an abelian group are given by the characters, and so you already know what the Fourier transform on ZR squared is. But let's see what it is concretely, because it's a simple thing to write down. Supposing I've got a function f, ZR squared for complex numbers, then f hat uv will be defined to be 1 over r, which is the square root of r squared. So I was really thinking about this 1 over r. Sum over all xy, fxy, e to the minus 2 pi I, ux plus vy. And if you want to calculate it, you can do it in two stages. What you can do is you can say, first of all, let's just fix y and think of it as a function in x. And take the Fourier transform in x, and then I'll get some function g u y, and then I'll fix this u part and work out the Fourier transform in y, and then I'll get f hat u v. I won't justify that in full detail, but it's an easy exercise to see that you can get a two-dimensional Fourier transform just by doing a pair of one-dimensional Fourier transforms. So, working out the Fourier transform in ZR squared, if you've got a nice quantum Fourier transform available, is also a very fast operation.
Do you have to divide by R squared in the exponential?
How do you mean?
Do you want ux plus vy over r squared? Or r?
Yes, you're quite right. Otherwise it's just an integer all the time.
Yeah.
This is a vr. Anyway, yes, thank you. So that it is, actually I prefer to write it. I can tell you exactly why I made that mistake. Because what I normally do is use a different notation, where I write omega to the minus ux plus dy, where omega equals e to the 2 pi I over r. So I've just sort of got used to not having to write the over r's in the exponent there.
But I just decided to spare people this omega notation in this course. Right. So now, let's just think what the Fourier transform of, well, what have we got? We've got some superposition. We've got, when we've done this measurement, we end up with the following function. We've got fxy equals 1 over the square root of r if x is congruent to t minus sy, and naught if x is not congruent to t minus sy. So where does this 1 over the square root of r come in? Well, it's because there are possible solutions to this, and they're all, so to speak, equally likely, and so we have this normalized effect of 1 over the root r. So now I want to work out what f hat of uv is. So I'll get 1 over r times 1 over the square root of r times the sum of all x congruent to t minus sy e minus 2 by I over r ux plus vy, which is better written as if US doesn't equal V, and so this works out to V. So if US equals V, then that's naught. So summing over Y and dividing by R will just give me e to the minus 2 pi I over R UT. And that's, sorry, that was if US and naught if, well, it's congruent to naught if V is not congruent to US mod R. I'm just taking out a factor e to the minus 2 pi I over R UT out to the side and using yet again the fact that sums over roots of unity either line up completely or cancel out completely. So what happens if I now take a measurement of the Fourier transform? It's going to produce for me a random pair UV with the property that V equals US. So let's just trying to find out what S is, and we've got a random pair like that. But it's not quite absolutely perfect, because R is composite. So we could work out what S is if we could just invert mod U, but if we could invert mod R, so take the inverse of U, but we can't always do that. However, what we can do is just run the experiment a few times. Suppose I manage to find pairs U1, V1. Well, let's write it as U1, SU1. And U2, SU2. If I do this a few times, again, what I said about the probability of two random integers being co-prime, after a pretty short amount of time, I will get a pair such that U1 and U2 are co-prime. And now, if you haven't forgotten your numbers and sets, you'll know exactly what to do whenever you have two numbers that are co-prime. And so we find H and K such that HU1 plus KU2 equals 1, and therefore H of this plus K of this equals S, and we've got our S. And that solves the discrete logarithm problem in polynomial time. So the rough message there is that a similar bag of tricks that gives you the order of an element also does a discrete logarithm, but we have to generalize to a two-dimensional Fourier transform. And it's been generalized further. People have said, well, what actually is the general thing that you can do? And it's something called the hidden subgroup problem. And I can't remember exactly what he said. It's something like you've got an abelian group and you've got a coset of a subgroup and you don't know what that subgroup is. And you've got to find some generators of the subgroup. They're quite hard to present it to you, I don't completely remember. Right. I think I'm going to stop there. I think I've said everything I wanted to say today. And so we'll finish the course now.